good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Hello, friend.
Just checking the carburetor.
Oh, well, you'll be interested in this end over here.
Ah. The owner must have been a woman. She left her sewing machine in the trunk.
Say, I can tell you know an awful lot about automobiles, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
Listen, don't you think that this car is a little too light for you? Huh?
I think you're right. Let's see something a little heavier.
Let me show you this over here, huh?
The so man, this is, Carol Shelby, engineer,
course,
race driver.
Sporty convertible.
The
but
car,
you don't want that.
The Shelby Mustang GT.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
To build my kind of car,
why wouldn't
I had to take an existing car and modify it.
No, I just...
I could have chosen any set of wheels
of
I wanted.
Type.
I picked
wouldn't
Mustang.
Want to drive around with this top down.
Oh, I see. You think I'm too level-headed for a car like this? Well, you see, the fact of the matter is, I'm buying this car for my young niece.
What a coincidence. This car belonged to a young niece of an old lady in Pasadena. That's right. She only drove it to the 4-H Club meetings once every month.
Oh. Well, then it must have had excellent care.
Sure.
But I tell you, I'd like to drive it around the block, though, before I buy it.
All right. Well, I got a better idea. Why don't you buy it first, then you can have pride of ownership when you drive it. Huh?
But I want to know if the motor is in good running condition.
Huh. Well, I'll turn it off and we'll take a look at it.
Has the motor been on?
Well, yeah.
Why, it's so quiet, I've hardly heard it.
Hardly? You mean you could hear it at all?
Just barely.
I guess I'll have to knock $25 off the price so you can get a new muffler.
How much you want for this car?
Wait a minute, I think I better find out if it's available. Hey, Blinky!
Yeah, boss?
That call from Hollywood. Mr. Grant's business manager come through yet?
Hollywood? Cary Grant?
You said it, I didn't.
Mr. Grant is due in from Europe today, and his manager is sure he wants the car.
Sorry.
Now, wait a minute. This car is on your lot, which means it's for sale, right?
Right, but I already promised it to someone else.
And if I give you a legitimate offer, you've got to take it, right?
Well,
I'm afraid he's got you, boss.
Okay, but you got to meet the price.
What is it?
$900.
Darn. Darn, 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 darn. I've only got $375.
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you have the car for $375. On one condition.
What's that?
You got to promise not to tell Cary Grant.
It's a deal.
Okay, friend.
Cary doesn't know won't hurt him.
So long, Pally.
So long.
So long.
thunder of jets in an open sky, a streak of gray and a cheerful...
A loop, a whirl, and a vertical climb, and once again, you'll know it's time for the adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle and friends.
Starring that supersonic speedster, Rocket J. Squirrel, with his pal, Bullwinkle the Moose, and a host of others.
Hurry, Bullwinkle! The show's about to start!
I'm coming as fast as I can!
Wave to the people!
Yay!
Now what are you doing?
Signing autographs! The Steve John Smith.
But your name is Bullwinkle!
I know, but that's hard to spell.
Hey, this is Tammy Edelbrock, and you're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Welcome. You're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computer. Ed, are you there? Are we okay? Norman 26. Oh, okay, well, anyway, hey, welcome. You're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I'm your show host, Robert. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. Don't forget to, if you've been seeing our past shows, check out NostalgicRadioCars.com. So, this is not a technical difficulty. I'm actually at a remote, undisclosed location, so we're going to be communicating back and forth. So, bear with us, ladies and gentlemen. This is how the radio show stuff kind of works. How you doing there, Ed? It's only Tuesday. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway. All right, so we got a pretty good show for you lined up this evening. We've got a great guest coming on in a little bit. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what I did here in the last couple of weekends. I haven't posted it on any of my social media yet, but there's been a few junkyards that I discovered here recently. And they're hidden out here in the middle of the state. So, I don't know if I talked about this once before, but there was one that I went to. I met a guy late in the afternoon. It was raining. Guy was 80-some-odd years old. Pretty cool, interesting guy, but you'd never find this junkyard in a million years, okay? And I'm not going to tell you where it is either. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, it's in West Central Florida. How about that? I'll narrow it down. At any rate, So I was looking, I'm on the hunt right now for, if anybody's listening, I need to set a 64 Galaxy Beanie hubcap. They used them on Fairlands in 64 also, and they won 64, 5, and 6 Ford F-150s. Now Falcons used a very similar one. If it had a V8, 5 lug, they're 10.5 inches in diameter. If they are a six cylinder, 4 lug, they are 9.5 inches. And I made the mistake of buying a set because I got excited, it got emotional, you know, which happens when you buy parts. And I overlooked the fact that they were small diameter. I wasn't even thinking about it. I just thought, oh, wow, these are really cool. Paid little, you know, decent money for them. They were nice, though. I mean, they were nearly perfect. But guess what? They don't fit a V8 or a 5-lug wheel. And interestingly enough, even though a Mustang has a 4.5-inch bolt circle and a Ford truck has 5-on-5, maybe the early ones, the later ones are definitely 5-on-5.5. The 10.5-inch diameter beanies actually fit the wheel. Go figure. Maybe something an engineer did right. But at any rate, so this old junkyard had cars going back to the early 50s. There's probably 300 cars, 250, between 200 and 300 cars in that junkyard. And fairly well picked. They'd been sitting there forever. I mean, they had moss, they had short of mushrooms growing off the top of these cars. They'd been sitting there for a while. So there was four 64 Galaxies there, two wagons, stuck in the mud. I mean, buried up to the axle. And lots of 55, 56 Fords, 57 Fords, Pontiacs, Oldsmobiles, Chevrolets, Novas. I think there was one Camaro, maybe a Firebird. Four Mustangs. Two of them had the roofs cut off, and one was a convertible, and one had the roof pushed in. All coupes, except for the one convertible. Countless trucks. I mean, if you're in a 58 to 72 Chevy trucks, or 67 and 78 or 72 Chevy trucks, a bunch of those. Now what was there basically was, you know, rear ends, some miscellaneous mechanical pieces, brackets, a few things like that. But as far as body parts, everything was rusty. Glass, if you needed it. Some trim was decent. And and then a bunch of junk motorcycles, and just, but the guy was a real nice, friendly guy, and we got along real well. I was there for about usually 2 hours, walking around in the rain. And when you're junkyarding, make sure you got boots on, okay? Because there could be snakes there. You never know. I didn't see any, but I'm sure there was sawdust. And but I remember the guy saying, you know, I'm 82 or 83 years old, and I'm out here following you around. He wouldn't let me open up any doors. He had to open up all the doors himself. The cars were piled with parts. There was vans and buses piled with parts. And just a lot of good old stuff, you know. I mean, it was kind of like a vintage car, vintage junkyard museum, just neat old cars, you know. So it's kind of like it's like live art is what it was. Nothing was really, really significant. There really wasn't anything worth restoring, but it was just like a piece. It's like a monument in a way, you know. It's kind of like what it was. It's kind of hard to explain. Just have to, if you're a junkyard guy, you get it. Well, then a couple days later, about a week and a half later, a friend of mine calls me up and says, hey, look, I saw a bunch of junk cars, crushed cars going down on a semi. And I go, what? And I said, uh-oh. Now, this was up in a little further north Florida. And there was this old junkyard, and I met this lady many years ago. I used to go to this junkyard. I used to go, you know, junkyards all over the state. That was my favorite pastime. But anyway, so I tried to get into this junkyard about 4 years ago, and every time the lady said, here's my number, call me. It's behind a gate, and I'd call. She'd never answer. I'd roll up there. The gate was closed, and, you know, you just don't want to trespass when you're out in the country. If there's a gate, you know, if there's no gate, then you kind of wander out, and you're in the open, chances are you're just a moving target at that point. But at any rate, so I scurried up to this junkyard, and sure enough, they were crushing cars. And I will be posting some of those pictures, because there were stacks and stacks and stacks of cars. And I'm sure Alan's going to cry in a few minutes, because there was a Volvo 122, which is called the Amazon. It was flat. The reason I was really upset, because there was a picture somebody sent me of a bug-eyed Sprite in that yard, and it was right up front, and it was one of the first cars that got crushed. Now, keep in mind, though, a crusher, it's just steel. But to guys like us, you know, there was countless Fords in there. They seemed to have a lot of Fords for some strange reason. But I remember when I rolled up there one time, there was a 69 Galaxy there with a 390 badge on it. So I'm guessing it was a 390, could have been 2-barrel or 4-barrel, but it was sitting there. So it got hammered. In the stack, there's pictures of Mustangs, 65, 66, style, 71, 72. So I took the liberty of walking around there, and I hadn't been there in years and years and years. I'm talking back in the 80s or 90s. And there was a 69 Torino in there, complete interior, bucket seat console, 70 Cougar, bucket seat console, pack engages, XR7 power windows, was a 390 car, a couple Mustangs, 69 Shell, Camaro Shell, 71 Challengers, 70, 71 Shell. Just make you cry. Just make you cry. I don't even want to talk about it anymore because I'm going to go cry. On that note, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to have Ed play a song. We're going to call our guest, and we'll be back in a few minutes with our guest for the special guest for the evening. So don't touch that dial. You're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Don't jump in that paddle wheel bumping. Black water, keep rolling on fast, just the same.
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me? Keep on shining your light. Gonna make everything great. Mama's gonna make everything alright. Ain't got no worries, cause I ain't in no hurry at all. Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me? Keep on shining your light. Gonna make everything, gonna make everything alright. Ain't got no worries, cause I ain't in no hurry at all.
Take me by the hand, pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland, pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand, take me by the hand, pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland, pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand, take me by the hand, pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland, pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand, take me by the hand, pretty mama, come and dance with your daddy all night long.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland, pretty mama, come and take me by the hand.
By the hand.
The man, Carroll Shelby, engineer, race driver. The car, the Shelby Mustang GT.
To build my kind of car, I had to take an existing car and modify it. I could have chosen any set of wheels I wanted. I picked Mustang. Mustang is styled right, lean and strong looking, not fat and round. And Mustang has that long list of features and options. I'll tell you, when it comes to imitations, I've seen some, but competition for the original, I haven't seen any. Only Mustang makes it happen. These aren't just words, it's a fact.
Ford has a better idea.
This is Bill Warner of the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance, and you're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, we're back, and you tune into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and it's time to introduce our special guest for the evening. This is a friend of mine from way back. He's also a very well-known automotive journalist. He's a judge at the prestigious, actually, Amelia Island and at Pebble Beach. I'm delighted to welcome the show. A alumni guest, Matt Stone. How you doing, buddy?
Some of us you just can't keep away. Hey, Robert, how are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm actually on your website, which is kind of cool, and you've written a number of books.
Yeah, I guess I have.
Yeah. Do you want to share some of the stories about some of those books? And, I mean, here's one on James Garner. That's pretty cool. And a lot of people don't really, probably didn't know that he was a big-time racer. And, obviously...
That was honestly something, Robert, that was really important to me. I wanted to do the holy trinity of Hollywood car guys. And, of course, that was McQueen, Newman, and Garner. And I did them. And I'm so pleased I did, and enjoyed every minute of doing those three books.
Did you have the rare opportunity to actually meet James Garner and Paul Newman and them?
I did meet and speak with James Garner face-to-face. Paul Newman I interviewed over the phone because he was getting a little ill at the time, but could not arrange face-to-face with him. And then, of course, Steve McQueen died when I was in college. So that was a tough get.
So when you take us through the process of, like, let's talk about James Garner, because I was always fascinated with him because, you know, he was in the movie Grand Prix. And in that particular movie, did he actually do any driving himself? Do you know?
Yes, he did. I do know. And he did quite a bit of his own on-camera driving. As a matter of fact, he did his driver training with Bob Bondurant, whom I know you knew. And went to the Bondurant school. And he and Garner and Bondurant used to go out to Willow Springs Raceway in Shelby Mustangs and formula cars and train. So he actually learned properly how to become a competent racer.
If you had to, when did he start racing? Was he in the early 60s? Because, I mean, he was working on his
say again, I didn't finish the question.
When did he, about what time did he start getting involved in racing? Early 60s, mid 60s?
James Garner was involved at a couple of different levels. First of all, he owned a professional sports car racing team in the late 60s and early 70s, late 60s primarily, and they raced L88 Corvettes, and they were on, you know, what we would now call the IMSA trail. You know, they raced at Daytona, and they did all the 12 hours and Sebring and all that jazz. So he owned that team. And he also did his own active behind-the-wheel racing, was primarily off-road. He raced Ford Broncos, like Parnelli Jones did.
Really? So was he friends with Parnelli Jones and Bill Strope and those guys?
They knew each other, for sure. And as I recall, one time at least, when maybe Parnelli wasn't running, Bill Stroop may or may not have been Garner's co-driver. But they certainly knew each other. And as I recall, that at least one of Garner's Broncos was built by Stroop.
Okay. Wasn't Garner the one that had the infamous Oldsmobile that was set up like an off-road vehicle?
Yes. I'm very familiar with that car. It is
okay, tell us about it.
Crazy, crazy car. It's the body is a 68 or 69 Oldsmobile 442 with a completely bespoke chassis and suspension and whatever. And the engine was mounted right where the front passenger seat would be. They made a mid-engine sidewinder out of it. And I believe Vic Hickey was involved in the building of that car. And they had a big block Oldsmobile engine in the right where the passenger seat front would be in a standard car. And it was blue and yellow and white and crazy, crazy car for sure.
Somebody said that car's still around.
It is. It is. It is owned by a family here in Central California that has kind of spent their whole life in and around the oil business and off-road racing. And, that car still exists. And for my book, we photographed it, and I got to watch people drive it. I mean, it's the craziest thing you ever seen.
When you do a book, you know, if you wanted to share some pointers with it, what is your process? I mean, to do that. So obviously, you have to do a lot of research, get your own information, and then there's a lot of writing involved, I'm sure. But how do you, like, from start to finish, when you plan this, what do you put on there as far as like your duration? In other words, like, you know, how intense do you get? I mean, obviously you want to have as much detail in there as possible because you want to make sure all the information in you gather is accurate and everything like that. But the process itself, I mean, your mindset and everything like that, what's it like to write a book?
Well, it's a lot of work, I'll tell you that. I don't know, 16 or 17 times now, and it is a lot of work, but it's truly the labor of love. And especially with people like this, and interesting cars and stories. To me, it's all about the value of the stories. And, of course, the cars and people and the history and the times all go with it. But what I do is when I kind of have a topic, I gather as much anecdotal information as I can find. I don't always trust it or believe it or stop there. But, I mean, I'll watch every TV show, every movie, every magazine article, every interview, every news. I mean, I just gather 50 pounds of stuff from the period and the time and the guy and the team and the cars. And that's kind of where it starts. And of course, based on that, you build a table of contents, which becomes the outline for your research. And then I try to find every person I can talk to who was there. And hopefully, sometimes, that's the star of the show, James Garner, Paul Newman, whoever. And in Steve McQueen's case, that was not possible because, of course, he'd passed away. But I try to talk to anything and everyone and every car and every race story. And I try to get as much primary information as I can. And then I kind of go through and whittle through all the anecdotal stuff and try to figure out what of this is valuable for the story I want to tell, and what if it is just meaningless gibberish or meaningless history that doesn't matter. So that's a little bit the process, and then a whole lot of writing, rewriting, and another thing that's really huge with these projects is finding and licensing and getting permission to use the photos. You're talking about, you know, things, events 30, 40, 50, whatever years old ago, 60, could be more. And you got to have pictures to help tell these stories. So archival photography, along with whatever new photography we can make happen, is a critical element. But gathering information by the pound creates a table of contents, which is an outline, and then you start at the beginning and go to work.
Let me ask you about the pitchers, though. That's kind of interesting. So if pitchers that were, let's just say, put out there for the public to look at, whether it's on the internet, whether it's past magazines, so you have to basically get permission to use those pictures. And I'm going to use Dave Friedman as an example because we all know Dave because he was the team photographer for Carroll Shelby in the early days until, I think, 65 or 66. So, but Dave's got a lot of pictures out there. So if you want to use some of Dave's pictures in your book, you have to get permission from him? And do you have to pay a fee, or how does that work?
That's correct. It all falls into the category of intellectual property rights. And,
okay.
And yes, by law and by fairness and professionalism, you know, you want to get permission to use that work and credit it accordingly. And it varies. Sometimes I've had people say, oh, yeah, you can use my stuff. Sure. And they send me a letter or I get a permission form. And some of them want money, and most of them do, and some of them just don't. But yeah, if you're doing it right, which is what most publishers require, and I personally require, is I want those intellectual property rights secured and clear, and nobody cries.
Well, see, a lot of people don't realize that there's more to just writing a book, you know, and particularly if you're doing, in a way, kind of a biography a little bit, you know, on someone, you know, and there are a lot of photos. A lot of them are personal and stuff like that. So, yeah, that stands to reason that, obviously, you know, you got intellectual properties involved and illegalities and cross T's and dot I's.
Yep, and you're right. A lot of people don't understand that. And it's a shame that, much like in the music business, so much of that stuff gets used and regurged and reprincipled and redone, and the people who put in the blood, sweat, and gears don't get credit, don't get paid for it, and I am opposed to that. So yeah, it is, chasing that stuff down is a lot of the work, the legwork, in doing a book like this that has a 50,000 word manuscript and can be, you know, 300 pages. And you have to, it can't just be gray pages. It has to have visuals, and you got to get that stuff the right way.
So start to finish on a book like this one about James Garner, what was your time frame? Is this like, we talking 6 months? We talking a year? We talking a couple of years? Give us an idea of what the duration was.
From me having the kernel of the idea and the publisher contracting me to do it, to the time I have it completely in a stack and turn it in, there was my process start to finish, takes about a year.
Okay.
I've never been able to do them much faster than that, and I haven't tried. I try to get to the right answer, not a quick answer. And, you know, then after that, of course, there's editing and layout and all the stuff that the publisher goes through. And then to get it from the pile of stuff that I hand them it to the printer, that's another 6 or 8 months.
So it could be a multi-year process before a book comes to the bookstore, so to speak.
Yeah, I've had a couple from start to finish, you know, to an idea in my pea brain to ink dry on paper take 2 years. But a year and a half to year and three quarters is pretty average.
Okay. So while you're working on this book, let's say James Garner's Mordering Life, you might be working on another book, which, like, I'm looking at your website here, and it's called My First Car, which I'll get into that in a minute. Or you might be working on more than one book at the time, correct? Just to kind of break up the monotony. Not to mention all the other stuff that you do, all the photography, all the judging, all the traveling and interviews and things like that. Right, Matt?
Yeah, it's called making a living. You got to process a little bit. But, of course, I've did a lot of magazine work over the years. And often, you know, my magazine work was the bread and butter that kind of keeps you alive while you're locking myself into the office doing a book. So, but I have had two going at a time, and that's a bit of a mental game of Twister, but I've done it and can do it, and will probably continue to.
The Smothers Brothers, was it Dick Smothers? Wasn't he a race car driver also, part-time kind of a hobbyist? And wasn't he associated with James Garner at some point?
That's correct. Yeah, Dickie Smothers actually was a pretty competent sports car racer. He raced smaller Formula cars, I want to say Formula 2 and Formula 5000 and really small bore Formula cars and sports cars. And I think he did drive for Jim Garner a couple of times when James had AIR, American International Racers. That was his racing team, which he set up and tried to establish as a business, a for-profit business, to where companies could advertise and sponsor, et cetera, et cetera. But Dickie Smothers was a pretty competent sports car racer. I mean, he wasn't a world champion by any stretch, but he was competent and could pedal.
Well, I believe he also drove one or two of Greenwood's Corvettes at some point in time, didn't he? Because I know he raced, if I remember correctly, because there was a Shelby that I was chasing one time. They raced up at Brainerd, and that particular car came in first in its class, only second overall to the car driven by, I believe, Dick Smothers, which was a Greenwood Corvette. And that was in 1972.
I am not an expert in John Greenwood's team or record, although I know who he is and what he did.
You're right.
But I believe that's ringing a bell in my head somewhere that Smothers drove for Greenwood in the Corvettes a little bit.
Well, that's interesting. There's a good example of kind of like what you do, connecting the dots. So then you can put the story together, you know, and of course I do appraisals and valuations on classic and antique cars. So a lot of times I'll be doing research and then it takes me over here and I read this for a while and then I go read this and I read that. And then sooner or later, I'm almost able to connect the dots. And that's kind of what you do when you put the book together. You've got to do this research and it takes you to maybe not necessarily a dead end, but a curve. And then you go around the corner and then you find out more information and then you keep working at it. And eventually, you have a wonderful book.
Yeah, that's true. It's all in search of the story, and sometimes you go down a dead rabbit hole, and other times it's a treasure hunt, and that's part of the fun in the game. The other thing I found to your point is there is absolutely no such thing as 6 degrees of separation. It's way less than that. I have a photo that's just brilliant. It's from one of the Baja races, and there's all the drivers are sitting in a grandstand, and somebody's up talking to them about how things go or whatever. This racing stewards, I don't know, but there's a picture of this grandstand, and in the front row is Steve McQueen and Bud Eakins, and just over
the
left shoulder and back about three rows is James Garner and Bill Stropp. 10 feet away.
Incredible.
Yeah, no such thing as 6 degrees of separation, especially in the older days when it was all a little lower key than it is now. But yeah, these are fascinating stories and interesting guys, and the pursuit is truly for me sometimes like following the yellow brick road.
I can totally understand that, and I can totally get into that because that, like I said, when I do appraisals, that's kind of like, especially when doing vintage race cars, you know, because you start finding all this history and it's fascinating because you not only focus on the one that is the particular vehicle that you're working on, but you find out a lot of other information that gives you ideas to pursue something else. Once the first project's done, it lines up other future projects for you, which is interesting.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And that has happened. I mean, you're following a path, and then all of a sudden it intersects with other roads and streets, and you're bumping along this person and that person, and then there's more interesting people and more stories and more cars, and fortunately, so far, I have not run out of material.
This book called My First Car. Tell us about that. What's that book about?
Well, it is a whole bunch of people from various intersections of the auto sphere, you might say. Designers, mm-hmm. race drivers, Hollywood types. The table of contents is full with a whole bunch of different folks telling the story of their first car. Whether that's astronaut John Glenn, Mario Andretti, Jay Leno, you know, I had all politicians, had all kinds of people, because everybody had a first car, and some of them were pretty interesting, and some of them were junk. And sometimes the junk stories are as interesting as the cool cars. So I don't know. I forgot how that germinated. I think maybe my publisher suggested it to me. But, just we made a list of interesting people that I felt that I knew or felt I could get to and ask them about their first car. And that's what it was. And yeah, some of them were kind of plebeian and nothing really all that special. And some of them were just charming.
Well, some of the names on here, you know, Tony Stewart, Carol Shelby, well, you know, Jay Leno, obviously. But when you put names in there like Dan Aykroyd, Tom Wolfe, and a few other of these people, they're not really car people. Did their first car have an impression make an impression on them that maybe down the road they became car enthusiasts, or do they look at a vehicle just as transportation? And is that in some of the stories?
Yes, it did. In a few instances, the first car became a conduit to them becoming, car savvy or car enthusiasts. And yeah, for others of them, it probably just didn't matter. And when it was an interesting part of the story, I put it in the copy for sure.
Who, out of all the people that you interviewed, who was the kind of like the least car-oriented person out of that? And how many people were in that? How many people did you interview, or how many people did you write about?
Oh, I would have to look at the table of contents, but I would guess it's probably 30.
Okay.
Maybe a few more, but who was the one that is just a car?
Mm.
Good question.
Yeah. It's just a car. Just, it's got four doors, four wheels, motor starts, window goes up and down. Yeah, it's got air conditioning, and it's transportation.
Yeah, offhand, I can't tell you. I can't identify that one person. I'd have to sit and thumb the book again to be able to answer that question. But, yeah, there were a couple of them that were slightly plebeian. No big deal. And then, some guys had some pretty interesting cars. One of them that won't surprise you at all is George Barris. His parents gave him a hand-me-down 1925 Buick. And he decided he wanted to try to make it different than just a beat-up old used Buick. So he went into his house, into his mother's kitchen, and took off a whole bunch of brass knobs off of the kitchen cabinets and screwed them into the grill of this car because he just thought it looked cool. Well, of course, what did he end up doing?
Yeah, building custom cars.
How about that?
Yeah, had an influence on him. Here's another book that you have.
That time.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And who knows, but some of the stories were really interesting. Peter Brock, whom is a gifted and famous automotive designer. He had like a little MG, I think was one of his first cars, and sports cars, and he was in sports cars his whole life, and still is.
He, he's best known for, designing the Daytona Cobra, which won Le Mans, or won the DT class in 1965, the World Manufacturer Championship for Carroll Shelby, which was pretty interesting. By the way, that brings up the movie. What are your thoughts on the movie, Ford versus Ferrari? Because I know you had a really close relationship with Carroll Shelby, and you've written some stories about him and a book.
Well, let's see. I think the movie, I enjoyed the movie a lot. It was Hollywoodized along the way, but I appreciate that they got most of the big stuff right. I mean, you know, when they said so-and-so finished second at Daytona, that happened. And,
right.
I mean, the big stuff, they generally got right. And, you know, certainly, like I say, some exaggeration and some Hollywoodizing, but generally the big stuff they got fairly accurately. And, you know, there's always certainly more they could have said, and maybe some things better left unsaid, but I enjoyed it a bunch. And it brought a story that a whole lot of people were not familiar with. I don't know. I mean, everybody, you know, knows who Shelby American and Carol and Cobras and all that. But the fact that they battled tooth, hammer, nail, and tong to win Le Mans in the 60s, not everybody is familiar with that. And that was a good story to tell.
Well, the thing that I liked about it was it really showed the relationship between 10 Miles and Carroll Shelby from a human interest side as well. And I always do the analogy, it's kind of like Roger Penske and Mark Donahue. In fact, we had Lance Stander on last week from the performance. And we were talking about the movie as well because he supplied some of the cars. And I'm not sure, were you involved in any of the stuff that went on with the movie at all? Were you any of the any of the scenes? Nothing?
No, I had no involvement there. But
okay.
Yeah, some of the stuff, and to the point you just made, I got to know later in his life and interviewed and wrote about, I don't know if you remember, a really excellent sports car racer and IndyCar driver named Lloyd Ruby, a Texan.
Yes, yes.
Lloyd
was 10 Miles
was
his co-driver.
Pardon me?
His co-driver
yeah.
at Le Mans.
And they were very, very, very close. Now, Lloyd told some marvelous stories about Ken and got a little emotional. Lloyd and Ken were very close and very good teammates, and were like brothers. There could not be two more disparate brothers. Lloyd was your cool cat, Texan. And, of course, you know, Ken Miles was your hyperkinetic Brit. And he said Lloyd told me that Ken Miles was just hyper, hyper, hyper all the time. And Lloyd would be sitting in the car, getting ready to start the race. He'd fall asleep. And he says, I don't think Ken Miles ever slept.
Huh.
Yeah, so those two guys were very close. And I would say you are correct that sort of a Penske-Donahue-esque relationship existed between Miles and Shelby. That's a very legitimate statement.
Another book here that you wrote on, and I've always been a big fan of his, you wrote one on Ed Iskenderian. We had Ed on a couple of years ago. I had Ed on, who was 101. That was a couple months before his 102nd birthday, and then I had him on 10 years ago. And he was the thing that, this guy's an inspiration to all of us. At 101 years old, he still remembers what he did in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he'll be 103 here in a week or 10 days.
That's right. That's in the summertime. Exactly.
103. My freaking goodness.
Yeah. Well, hey, we're catching up, though. But I mean,
he's a specimen and a freak of nature. But that's what made that book, doing that book, so much fun and possible, was the fact that he's got a memory like a steel trap. And I would go to his office and into the can factory there, and we'd find some office that was stacked from floor to ceiling with books and magazines and camshafts and boxes and car parts and junk and stuff. And I would sit in a chair that probably had five cams sitting on it, and he would sit behind a desk, and he'd lean back, and he said, okay, where were we? Ed, we were at Bonneville in 1952, and it was like pressing play on a tape recorder. He got, yeah, I remember we were down there with the Studebaker and the Model A and Mickey Thompson, and it just, out it came. No stumbling, no bumbling, no missing names. I mean, that guy is, at least when I did the book, encyclopedic in terms of memory and recall. And that made it so much fun.
Are there, who else is out? We got about a couple minutes left here, Matt. Who else would you like to write a story about? I mean, is it, does your publishers come to you, or do you take the initiative to write about somebody that you think people would be fascinated with?
It kind of goes both ways. Sometimes I'll have the kernel of the idea. That was McQueen's Machines. That was that was mine for more, and I went to the publisher and sold it. And sometimes they'll call me and say, hey, we kind of think it's time for a book about X. Are you interested? And the answer is most times yes, sometimes no. But that's a two-way street. I have on the press right now a new from scratch, ground up, complete, hopefully telling of the DeLorean saga. There hasn't been a DeLorean book in some years, and they're either some of them aren't very good, or they're not very complete, or they're not up to date anymore. So I did DeLorean from the day he was born in Detroit, Michigan. And the whole thing about the whole car, the birth of the company and the death of the company and the movie and the trial and, you know, the whole DeLorean saga, that's on press right now, and that will be out in September.
Super. Well, there's a connection there with Malcolm Brickman. We had him on the show here about a month or so ago. But at any rate, hey, Matt, we're up against the clock here. I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at the Nostalgic Radio and Cars. People want to find out more about you real quick. MattStone.com?
MattStoneCars.com.
MattStoneCars.com. Super. Yep. All right, Matt. Well, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. It was certainly a pleasure. Great stories. We'll have to do this again in the future, and I'll probably see you at a Pebble.
Yeah, thanks a ton, and let's do it again.
Super. Thank you very much. Hey, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't touch that dial, because we're going to be back next week. Same time, same bat station, same bat channel. But make sure you tell all your friends to follow us on social media. Check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the 10 o'clock radio network. Stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.